Hello and welcome back to Immigrantly. I am your host, Sadia Khan. I am back with our usual interviews. I hope you enjoyed our Bodily series with Mario Carrillo. What a fun and meaningful way to start 2026. This year, I want Immigrantly to be a place where we intentionally create space for creators, organizers, and thinkers to tell their stories in fuller, more human ways. So don't be surprised if we drop another series along the way. But for now, I'm really excited to be back. Right now, I know the world feels like it's imploding. It's loud, overwhelming, and sometimes it can make us feel helpless. When that happens, here's how I cope. I take small steps, meaningful ways to engage and contribute. For instance, last week I read a book by an immigrant author I am interviewing today. Next week, I might donate to an organization that provides legal support to undocumented immigrants, or I may talk about Know Your Rights because so many people still don't know them. And I get it, this isn't much, but it's my way of saying I'm paying attention. And that brings me to today's guest. I recently started reading Migrant Heart, and it made me pause. Not because it was dramatic, but because it was honest in a way that felt unguarded. The book traces love, loss, family, and the emotional inheritance of migration. But what stayed with me was how much of it lives in the in-between, between countries, relationships, between who we were and who we are still becoming. My guest today is Reina Grande, an award-winning writer whose work spans memoir, fiction, and essays, and whose storytelling has long explored migration, belonging, and the emotional shadows of displacement. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Hello, Reina. It's been a while since I interviewed somebody. So you are my first interview of 2026.
Oh, yay.
When was the first time we connected? It was last year, right?
Yes.
I think it was November when I reached out to you and didn't realize you don't check your email often. And then it got delayed. And then we launched a series, Bodily, which we are very proud of. And here we are. But it did give me an opportunity to read your book, Migrant Heart, at least the beginning of it, which is such a pleasure. But before we get into your book and your life, how is your heart today?
My heart? Oh, that's such a great question. I think this year started off in a really awful way. I think collectively there's been a lot of hurting, a lot of worry, anxiety, and I was very hopeful that this year was going to be a little better, and then it just started off awful, as you know, with the things unfolding in the country. I think I have been really trying to stay focused on some of the good things in my life, especially being safe at home with my family. I have my writing that gives me comfort. It gives me solace. And so I think for me, that has been so important in terms of navigating all the horrendous things that I'm seeing happening here. So yeah, I think today I woke up with gratitude, gratitude that my family is safe, that I have my writing, that I can have a voice to express how I'm feeling and try to do something for my community.
That's so good to hear, Reina. And when you say your writing gives you solace, how so?
My writing has always helped me to be able to unload a lot of the things that I carry in my body, you know, especially a lot of trauma, a lot of pain and hurt. And so writing for me gives me a safe space where I could say what I need to say and allow myself to feel all these things sometimes that I try to suppress, because the page is safe for me. There's a word in Spanish that I really love. It's called desahogar, which literally means to undrown. And that's what writing has been for me. You know, that's how I undrown myself.
Reina, when you say writing, do you have writing for self and then writing for others? Is there a difference between how you unload versus what you share with the world?
Well, you know, that's such an interesting question, because that is something that I have been grappling with more and more, in that when I was a younger writer, I wasn't yet published. I would write a lot for myself. You know, I would keep journals. I would write stuff that I didn't necessarily immediately think I'm going to publish this. You know, it was just write. But then after, once I got published and then, you know, writing became my career, it seems like everything I write now is for public consumption, especially because of time constraints now. Like every hour that I have towards writing tends to be for a book I'm working on that's going to be published, or an essay I'm working on, or something that's going to be published. And so finding precious time where I could just write for myself has gotten harder. Every few days a week, I try to make some time to still like keep my journal. Although I realize that mostly what I do now in my journals is just record what happened that day. There's not a whole lot of reflection or me like really putting down deep thoughts, because I do those in my other writing.
Do you think your journal is more mechanical, where it's like, okay, these are the five things that happened this day? And as you said, then the emotional labor that goes towards your writing for others, right?
Yeah. I think what happened too is, you know, after 20 years of being a published writer, I tend to think of my readers now when I sit down to write, and to have a kind of engage with them through the page. So as I'm working on something and I'm trying to process and reflect on an experience, I'm also thinking about how will the reader connect with this, with this experience as well. What do I want to say to this reader? What would they need to hear, you know, as a way to not just connect, but also to offer them comfort through the words that I'm writing.
Oh my God, Reina, this is so interesting, because as you were describing how you are more intentional about your readers now, I was wondering if you were more guarded or more unadulterated with your readers. Like, thinking about readers, does it let your guardrails up, or does it liberate you in some ways?
I don't think my guard goes up, because I have gotten used to being very open with readers. I think I've done a lot of public speaking for many, many years. And at the beginning, when I first started, when my first book came out in 2006, and I would, you know, be invited to share my immigrant experiences or other experiences, I remember how hard it was to talk about myself and to open up like that, you know, with an audience. But then I started to get more and more comfortable doing that because I realized like every time I allow myself to be vulnerable on stage, afterwards, people will come up to me and say, oh, you know, that happened to me too. I went through that too. And then they would want to tell me their stories. And so then I realized like, oh, this is how I'm connecting with people. When they see me be vulnerable, when they see me allow myself to go to some uncomfortable places, then it gives them permission to do the same, you know? And then the other thing I realized that started to happen too was that the more I shared and I talked about experiences, they were losing their power over me.
Huh. Talk some more about that.
Yeah. Like I realized like a lot of times I would be ashamed of things that happened to me. But once I talked about them and I talked about them again, I realized like, wait a minute, I'm not going to be ashamed of these things anymore. I'm going to, you know, be open about it, share it with people and just release them. And in releasing them, I freed myself. And then I realized too, as the more I talked about them and shared, was that a lot of the things that I was ashamed of, I should never have been ashamed of them. You know, those things taught me some really valuable lessons. You know, I feel like I gained a lot of resilience from experiences that I went through. And the mistakes, especially, you know, as a young person, that's how we learn, right? We learn from our mistakes. We learn from trial and error. We have to take risks. And yeah, sometimes, you know, we might lose our way, but that's how we learn. That's how we learn how to navigate. And that's how we figure out who we are and what kind of life we want to have. And so I started to reframe the way I saw a lot of these experiences. And I went from shame to actually being proud.
Wow.
Yeah.
Rina, you said things that you felt were shameful at the time. What were some of the things, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think one example is being ashamed about, you know, being undocumented, right? I crossed the border when I was 9, and I started to internalize a lot of shame about that, about my identity as an undocumented immigrant, especially because, you know, I was going through these experiences, like, at school and in my community where I was made to feel less than because of that. In school, my teacher, you know, she tended to ignore me a lot because I didn't speak English, and her way of dealing with the Spanish speaking kids in the class was just to ignore them and put us in a corner. So then I started to be ashamed of being a Spanish speaker. I started to be ashamed of my mother tongue. Then I started being ashamed that my parents didn't speak English. And I worked really hard to learn English so that I wouldn't spend, you know, the rest of my life in the corner, being ignored, being voiceless and invisible. But, you know, that shame just continued to dictate like the way I moved around in the world. And I wouldn't want to, you know, share that I was undocumented, that I had crossed the border. I tried every which way to assimilate and to try to belong. But then when I got older, you know, when I got to university, by that point, like, you know, I hardly spoke any Spanish anymore. I had a really bad relationship with my parents. I was really ashamed of them. I had internalized that as a Mexican, I didn't belong in this country, that I was the foreigner, that I was the outsider. And when I was in college, I started to work towards reframing the way I saw myself. I had a really great mentor, my Spanish teacher. She really helped me to see that being an immigrant had not made me less than, it had made me more. you know, like she would say, Reina, you're bilingual, you're bicultural, you're binational, you're not less, you are more. And then I took a history of Mexico class that helped me to learn some of the history that I hadn't been taught in U.S. classrooms.
Yeah, of course.
And that's when, and then that's when I learned, like, wait a minute, California, where I live, used to be part of Mexico. We were here first. Why am I letting people make me think that I'm the outsider, that I'm the foreigner? You know, this was Mexico first. Spanish was spoken here first before English. I started to just become more empowered the more I learned about, you know, the history, the more I learned about my community and about myself. And that's how I shifted that mentality from being ashamed of things to actually celebrating them and saying, no, this is who I am. And then the other, you know, beautiful thing that happened too in terms of my identity as a border crosser was that I realized that that was my superpower, because as a, you know, I crossed the border as a 9-year-old and I survived. I lived through the experience. I arrived here and I realized that if I could cross the most dangerous border in the world at 9 years old, I could cross any border, right? All these, you know, metaphorical borders, legal borders, cultural borders, everything. And so then that became my superpower. And I, like, every time I was confronted with like a barrier, with an obstacle, with some difficulty that I needed to overcome, I would tell myself, you know how to cross borders. That's my source of strength now.
Reina, you talked about your parents a little, and as I was researching for this interview, I read some of your interviews, and it seems like you've had a difficult relationship, especially with your father. You crossed border at 9, but your parents were here before that, and you were resentful that they left you. You felt abandoned. But at some point, you were able to understand their perspective. Did you realize that maybe they didn't have a choice? And how did that shift impact your relationship with your parents?
I think when I was younger, for sure, I used to be more judgmental of my parents. I think this happens with young people. We tend to be very judgmental of our parents. But the older I got, especially when I became a mother myself, I started to rethink some things. I do feel that I have finally arrived at a place where I feel a lot more compassion for my parents than when I was younger. You know, I understand now that my parents were struggling with a lot of things, and I tried to see them in terms of like political, historical, and social context. And understand, right, that some of the things that they did, they were forced into doing those things. So I totally get that. So I think with my father, for example, I have so much compassion for him because my father was put in a really hard place in terms of being the head of the household, having to provide for his wife and his children, and living in a place, you know, in Guerrero, Mexico, in a very, very poor, poor town where he didn't have the means. You know, he was a very hard worker. My father had a very strong work ethic, but no matter how hard he worked, the money just wasn't there. And so he wasn't able to provide for his family. And he made a choice that no parent should ever have to make, which is to leave his children and also his wife to and go to another country to look for a better way to provide for them. And then not only that, but eventually he had to make another very difficult choice that no parent should ever have to make, which was to bring his children across the border. And that really breaks my heart, like thinking about my father's choices. And, you know, then I think of myself as a mother now with my two kids. And I think, would I ever make the same choice to risk my kids' lives like that, or to have to leave my kids? And then I realized, wait, I'm the lucky one, because the choices that my parents made now mean that I don't have to make those choices for my kids. And that gives me a lot of gratitude to know that I don't have to go through that, that I don't have to be confronted with those very difficult choices.
Let's pivot to the immigrant identity, because that's the central theme for this conversation, right? You talked about how when you were younger, you were trying to assimilate and you were ashamed of your language and culture. But then you gradually started to reclaim it. But what I have realized with immigrants, I am an immigrant who grew up in Pakistan and I've been in this country for over 24 years. I feel as immigrants, we negotiate so much of ourselves. What gives, what we take, how do we create space in a new country? How much of our language and culture we have to sacrifice to appear palatable? And it's tiring. Maybe initially it happens more and gradually it tapers off, but it never fades away. Have you ever felt that burden of constant negotiation and renegotiation about what parts of me I can share and what parts of me I still have to hide in some ways?
I definitely feel it, like with language. We live in a country that doesn't value multilingualism.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's so centered on English only, English only. And I felt that since the very beginning, you know, when I arrived here and I was in an English only classroom and I couldn't use the language I knew to communicate. And then I had to learn English as quickly as possible at the expense of my Spanish. And it took me a really long time to learn the term of what happened to me, which is subtractive bilingualism.
Huh, interesting.
And what it means is, because when you learn a second language, ideally it's in addition to your native tongue, right? So it's, you're adding. But with a lot of immigrant kids, what happens is, instead of adding, we are replacing. We're replacing our mother tongue with English. So we're really not learning or you know, as a second language. We are subtracting our language to make room for English. And so that's kind of what happened to me. And it got to a point where my Spanish was really bad. I could still like speak casual Spanish because my parents didn't speak English. So I had to learn, I had to speak Spanish to them. But even like with my siblings, we just spoke English all the time and everything just became, you know, English, English, English everywhere I went, in college, everything. And even here at my house, you know, the primary language that we speak here is English. And with my kids, like, that is something that I really regret so deeply, is that I didn't teach my kids Spanish.
Why?
Because of that shame, you know, because of that internalized shame, and because everything has been, my life has been English, you know, everywhere and even at home. And I didn't see bilingualism as a gift that I could pass on to my kids. So like, my son doesn't speak Spanish beyond level one, you know. Luckily with my daughter, when we moved when she was in second grade, to Northern California, and the community we moved to had a dual language immersion program in English and Spanish. And I begged the school to please let my daughter, you know, into the program. And they tested her and she almost didn't pass because the program starts in kindergarten and it was already second grade. And so they tested her Spanish and she could only say words like leche, agua, papá, mamá, but she couldn't say sentences. And so they almost didn't let her into the program, but luckily they did. And she's, you know, she's bilingual and she's done Spanish all the way through. And now she's about to graduate high school and she's going to get the seal of biliteracy, you know, from the state of California. But even like example, even last night, I was speaking Spanish to her and she would reply in English. She never talks to me in Spanish.
Maybe at some point she will. I feel like kids have this way of internalizing. They're like sponges, right? They will absorb everything. I speak my mother tongue to my kids and my older one is able to communicate, but my younger one only responds in English. But then when she has to, she will switch. Like my mother doesn't speak English. So when she's talking to my mother and when she calls, you know, my mother in Pakistan, she is forced to speak in that language. And she does. She is able to structure sentences, although not neatly, but she can still communicate, right? So I'm pretty sure your daughter at some point will start communicating. Rena, talking about your book, Migrant Heart, why did you name it that?
I really wanted to use that word immigrant or migrant, especially in times like now. And I was having a conversation, you know, with my editor when we were thinking about titles. And there was a comment that she made about how the media tends to not like books or things that have like migrant in them or immigrant in them. And
you know, it's
like sometimes we immigrants have to package our stories in a way that's going to appeal to the mainstream. And they're like, oh, no, let's not use anything immigrant, anything with borders in it or anything like that. I'm like, well, why not? Like, this is what this book is about. Like, let's reclaim it. You know, let's use it as a way to say no. Like, we're not gonna avoid using certain words just because the media or whoever else that it's not gonna appeal to them. And that's how we ended up like saying no. Let's use this. You know, Migrant Heart. I really like the title. I like the subtitle that, you know, my editor came up with was Essays About Things I Can't Forget. And the cover, I was blown away by the cover. I think it's really gorgeous cover.
It's a beautiful, beautiful cover.
It is. I wanna get it tattooed.
How do you think Migrant Heart, as in heart, is different from any other heart? How is your heart different?
Well, I think as an immigrant, I have been able to develop a different way of seeing the world.
How so?
Yeah, like my experiences as a Mexican and then living in the US and being able to rotate in and out of both cultures has helped me to see the beauty of both cultures, both countries, both societies, but also be able to see what's bad with them too. And so I love both of them. And then I'm able to criticize both of them too, to see the flaws and see the beauty. I also feel like it gives me a different lens in terms of how I see the world and my place in the world. As you know, immigrants, there's immigrants all over the world where people that have been, you know, forced to leave our homelands, that we have a lot of differences, but also a lot of similarities. And so this also helps me to connect with immigrants from different places, different cultures, different backgrounds, and to understand, like, as a community of migrants, you know, these are things that we have gone through. We shared similar sorrows, similar traumas, but also dreams, you know, similar dreams and hopes, and the way we work so hard to give the best of ourselves to this country. So that's what I feel like my migrant heart, you know, with all its wounds, there's also a lot of beauty there.
But beyond what we can give to this country, because a lot of times I feel when we think about immigrants, we tend to, and as immigrants as well, we tend to frame it in the context of why we are worthy of living here. But to me, the reality is it's a transactional relationship. We are worthy of it because we deserve to be here. As you said, we bring so much culture, uniqueness, so many things beyond the labor.
I think when I talk about giving the best of ourselves and honoring, right, like you said, like all the contributions, everything that we have to give to this country, I say it because a lot of the rhetoric when it comes to immigrants is the opposite. Like, you know, they're always anti-immigrant, people are always talking about us as takers, not givers. And so I do want to acknowledge that, no, we're not takers. Like, we're actually givers, and we have a lot of things that we give to this country, as you mentioned. With my migrant heart, I mean, I think for us as a community, one thing that I feel we don't talk enough about is that forced displacement that takes place, and how we don't talk enough about how the U.S. has created that displacement, how foreign policies and practices and invasions. I mean, we just saw the United States invade Venezuela. You know, people are not thinking about how the cause and effect of things. So, you know, the U.S. has invaded Venezuela, taking their oil, taking their money, right? From the oil, and that's just going to cause a lot of migration. A lot of, you know, Venezuelans
are forced
to leave their homelands, leave their homes, and migrate. And so a lot of times, I think what makes me really upset is not seeing that correlation.
That's true.
Between what the U.S. does to other countries, how it upends the lives of people in other countries. It disrupts, you know, their social life, their government, everything, their economy, and then it creates migration.
Absolutely.
And yeah, so that is something that I feel that as an immigrant, you know, it's personal to me, what I see happening. And when I think about people who are going to be turned into migrants because of the things that this country and this government is doing.
Yeah, no, that's so true. People are just looking at the oil right now, unfortunately, and the minerals. I want to ask something specifically about Migrant Heart, the book. First of all, it's a compilation of personal essays. You've written fiction, but this is more personal. Why did you decide to pivot to that?
This is actually almost like the third installment of my memoirs. I have written two other memoirs prior to this. Migrant Heart is different from the other two. Stylistically, it's different because the other two are more like traditional chronological stories, you know. My coming of age in The Distance Between Us, which was the first memoir I wrote, I mostly focus on my childhood in Mexico, being separated from my parents, and then my border crossing, and then my young adulthood in the U.S. And then in A Dream Called Home, which was a sequel, I focused more on my young adulthood, going, you know, becoming the first in my family to go to university, pursuing my dream of being a writer, and learning how to build a home for myself. And so then in Migrant Heart, I wanted to write more about my experiences, but in a different way from the other two books. And that's why I decided that this was going to be written in essays instead of a more, you know, chronological story in chapters. The essay format allowed me to explore experiences in a different way, where I didn't have to like worry about the narrative arc, the plot points. It was more about theme. Each essay is wrapped around a theme. And, you know, there's one essay where I write about my language trauma and subtracted bilingualism, like I've mentioned before. I write about growing up, being abused by my father. And then when I became a mother, I started to abuse my son. I had to work really hard to break that cycle of violence in my family. So that essay was just wrapped around that, you know, just about the cycle of abuse and how to break it. And then I write another essay about menopause, you know, and that's all that essay was about. So writing essays really helped me to pin down what are some of the themes or topics that I'm really interested in right now. What experiences am I going to write about that tie into those themes, and do it in short form where I don't have to sustain a story for, you know, 300 pages, but just 15 pages of it.
You know, what's fascinating to me about this book is that it really focuses on immigration or migration from a different lens. So it's not just about moving bodies. It's not like physically you're moving from one place to another. It's how intimacy, trust, love, relationships, unfortunately abuse, are formed, the emotional costs of immigration or migration, which people hardly talk about, right? There is this myth of American dream. Everybody has a different pathway, but at the end of the day, that's what you really aim for. You've mentioned so many themes just now, from abuse to vulnerability to menopause, which is a difficult topic to talk about, right? But something that really caught my eye in the very beginning of the book was there's this moment where you talk about feeling the need to apologize almost preemptively for how your writing may make readers feel. And that stayed with me. Like, why do you think you carry that impulse or need to apologize?
That's interesting. I think for sure, I feel like I do that often in my daily life, where I do feel bad about how I make others feel. Sometimes I always think that people are angry at me because of my upbringing, you know, with my father, the abuse that I suffered with my father. He always made me feel that I had done something wrong, and I didn't know what I had done wrong, but he was always angry, like always angry. And he wouldn't talk to us. He had, you know, a frown on his face. And every time we were, you know, around him, we were walking on eggshells because he would lash out or, you know, hit us or yell at us out of nowhere. We never knew, like, what did we do? You know, what did we do to make him upset? And so now I understand, like, it wasn't us, it was the world that made him angry. He was always angry and bitter and resentful about everything. But I always took it as I did something wrong. It's my fault that he's feeling that way. And so I noticed that as an adult, I still do that, you know, sometimes with my husband, like sometimes he has on a serious face and automatically I feel like he's mad at me. I did something wrong. I always assume people are mad at me.
Yeah, because in this case, you're just sharing your truth. Why apologize for that, right?
Yes.
And however it makes people feel, that's the choice that they are making by engaging with that truth. You're not forcing anybody to do it, right? And as women, not just as immigrants, I think as women, we do it a lot, right? It's always like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It's a very common phrase, especially among women. I've caught myself using it often. And then I'm like, but why am I apologizing? There are instances where if my team says something like, I'm sorry, I'm like, you don't have to apologize. Not that apologizing is a bad thing. Like, we should apologize when we make mistakes, when we have missteps. It's about apologizing because there is so much burden on us to somehow justify or give ourselves permission to take space or to share our point of view or to tell our truths. I think that's where we don't need to apologize. Rena, what do you hope people to take away from this particular book?
Well, similar to my other memoirs, one of the intentions that I had with writing this book and sharing this, a lot of vulnerable moments, is to, you know, for other people to find comfort, right? To find that they're not alone in their own struggles, that we've gone, you know, so many of us have gone through these things, and we have not just survived, but we've learned how to thrive in spite of that. So I want to give people that inspiration and to make them feel less alone and to give them that courage, you know, to keep living their best lives possible and to not allow, you know, these traumatic moments to hold them back, but to...
Or to define them, absolutely.
Yeah, to turn them into their superpowers.
We started with the current situation, right? What's happening in the U.S. For listeners who do feel overwhelmed right now by uncertainty, politics, fear, what does paying attention look like to you in practice?
I think there has to be a balance, because sometimes we can fixate on things, pay too much attention, and that becomes overwhelming. And, you know, you have to give yourself permission to step away from that, to tune out and do some self-care, you know, to turn the world off and just step away and turn inward and be with yourself, spend time with yourself, and do things that give you joy.
What things give you joy?
I, you know, like just these past few days, I've been doing a lot of gardening.
Ah, nice.
The weather has finally turned and we're getting sunny days again. And so I've been out in my vegetable garden, getting rid of all the weeds, preparing the soil, because I'm going to be planting my vegetables soon. And so that, I have taken a break from like reading the news and whatever, this past two days while I'm doing that, because it gives me joy to prepare my vegetable garden to be planted, right? To get rid of all the bad stuff, to clean it, clear it, so that it can give life again. And so I'm really looking forward to planting those seeds and watching them grow and, you know, just giving new life and helping that. I also do a lot of sewing. Recently, like, you know, a few days ago, I was fixing some of my daughter's coats because she went thrifting and she bought some really beautiful coats, but they fit her too big. So I've been resizing them on my sewing machine. And that like gives me a lot of joy to be able to do that for my daughter. You know, that's the way I show love. My love language is doing things for my family.
And in the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word, a sentence, a phrase, how would you do that?
Complicated.
I like the word. It's short and sweet. And yes, it indeed is very complicated. Where can people find your book?
You can find it anywhere in your local bookstores or anywhere you buy books. You could also go to my website at reinagrande.com to read more about my books and about me, and also to see where I'm going to be. I have an events page where I list all my upcoming presentations.
Thank you, Reina. This was such a good conversation, and I'm glad we were finally able to sit down and talk about immigrantness.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, guys, full disclosure. As I said in the beginning, this is my first interview after a month and a half. So I'm not going to lie, I was a bit nervous. I was trying to think back to what makes me excited about interviews and the kind of questions that I want to ask my guests. You'll be hearing more of me in the coming weeks. I'll bring you another great guest next week. Also, what I said in the beginning, we are thinking of doing a few other series during the year. We don't know when. One series that I am particularly interested in is to trace the origins of Muslim existence, Muslim identity in America, basically origins of Muslims in America. So if you are a journalist, if you are a storyteller, a writer, interested in something like that, do reach out to me at sadia@immigrantlypod.com. Again, I don't know when that series will come together, but that's something that I do want to create. This episode was written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another conversation. Until then, take care and be safe.